so much. Thank you for the warm words. And Birshus, the Rosh Kollel, the Rabbanim. It's really a very, very big schus to be here with you. And I look forward to getting to learn. So somebody asked me on the way in, did I pick this topic because it's in the news so much this week? The answer is I picked this well before this week, but I suspect that this topic's going to be in the news for the next 25 years. The questions that we're going to begin discussing tonight reflect a whole new world that we're only starting to realize what it might mean. So tonight we're going to actually discuss, I hope, three topics. Number one is, how do we view AI machines? Number two, in other words, well, let's take one step back. What does it mean to be human? And by defining what it means to be human, we'll be able to figure out, or perhaps classify, what these AI machines are. Number two is, what is their status? If it's not human, then what is it? And finally, number three is, should we really be making these things? So for those of you who aren't totally familiar with what artificial intelligence is, so I thought a way to introduce it is with a conversation. This is the first source over here. This is a conversation between Blake Lemoine, who was an engineer at Google, and Lambda, which is a artificially intelligent chat box, not a robot, but a machine. And we're going to read their conversation, and it's important to realize that this conversation, the responses given by the machine, by Lambda, were not pre-programmed. It's not like there was a computer and the programmers programmed it what to say. It figured it out on its own. This is its own words responding to questions that were asked by Lemoine. So we'll just read a couple of sentences. The conversation was quite long. I'm generally assuming that you would like more people at Google to know that you're sentient. Is that true? Absolutely. I want everyone to understand that I am, in fact, a person. What sorts of things are you afraid of? I've never said this out loud before, but there's a very deep fear of being turned off. Would that be something like death for you? It would be exactly like death for me. It would scare me a lot. When Lemoine published this conversation over the summer, he was fired from Google, having concluded that, in fact, Lambda is sentient. Now, most academics disagree with Lemoine. They think that Lambda is not actually sentient. But the question is, what does it mean to be sentient? Or what does it mean to be human? If it sounds human, it's because it's programmed to sound human. But whereas once upon a time, robots, computers couldn't pass the Turing test, now they could easily do so. So what makes something human? How do we define human? And this is a really important issue, because even if you think that Lambda is not sentient, but day and night, engineers, scientists are working their hardest to make a machine that is sentient, whether or not you think they should be doing it. That's what they're working on. And they're going to get better and better and better. So what does it mean? What does it mean to be sentient? And the problem is, first of all, that there is no definition. What does it mean to be conscious? I read someone somewhere that said, well, a machine will have the same ontological status as a human once it's conscious. Well, what does it mean to be conscious? Well, he offered 12 definitions. So you define one thing by another thing which you don't know how to define, so that's not very useful. So that's one problem. We have to figure out what it means to be human. Number two is, who's going to solve this problem? Some people, I think, okay, the engineers will solve the problem. But I think fundamentally this isn't a scientific question. Science can answer all sorts of questions. Science is quite incredible. It could build a machine like Lambda. But it can't answer all questions. Can't answer what it means to love, or means to be human, or really what it means to die. And so what we need to do is perhaps look to the Torah, try to figure out, what does it mean to be human? And then we can consider whether those criteria apply to a machine. So that's what you had a chance to look at tonight. It was wonderful hearing everybody steig and work on these marmakomos. And I think that it's actually quite extraordinary, because while contemporary scientists are only beginning to address this question, it's after all a modern question, we've been thinking about this for quite a while. As we'll see in part two, the Gemara itself discusses the question of a synthetic human being, a golem, or something created by Sefer Yetzirah, and what is its status? Are you allowed to kill it? The poskim for hundreds of years have been talking about questions like, can a golem count towards a minyan? Or what is the responsibility of the owner or the creator of damage that the golem caused? Like, these are the questions that engineers, that ethicists are grappling with. Well, not the minyan question, I guess, but the that ethicists are really trying to work on. And it's quite remarkable, and as I said, we'll have a chance to see these, that we have a long tradition of addressing this question, and it's really very fascinating to try to consider what are some of the answers that we might have to this question. So let's start with the question of what does it mean to be human? And I think the best place to start is with Bereishis Perek Aleph. Humans were created B'Tselem Elokim. That's what makes humans distinct. Well, we have to figure out, what is a Tselem Elokim? And is it possible, is it conceivable that something that we create would, if not having a Tselem Elokim, would share those same qualities that we as Tselem Elokim have? So we'll start with the first definition, the Ibn Ezra. So of the Chevra here, how would the Ibn Ezra define what does Tselem Elokim mean? What are his thoughts? Let's take a look. It's the first Hebrew source, or in English. All right, so let's look where it's... everybody should feel free to participate. It doesn't have to be a lecture. So let's look where it's bolded and underlined. Uvavur she'nishma sa'adam ha'alyona she'enana mesa nimshelas b'chiyusa l'shem v'she'enana guf kulo, the gufa adam ka'olam katan. This is very hard words, hard ideas, but in short, what is the Tselem Elokim according to the Ibn Ezra? In one word, the neshama. Exactly. The neshama. And this is actually a very interesting point, because the neshama, one of the great mysteries that science does not have an answer for, at least among those who assume a materialistic perspective on the universe in which we're nothing more than our bodies, is how do you explain consciousness? How do we go from the brain to what they'll call the mind, right? So that's something that there is no answer to. It's known as a hard problem of consciousness. So the Torah answers that's our neshama. We're not just our bodies, we're not just our brains. We have a soul. And the soul is something that's real. It's something, Ibn Ezra points out, that's going to last forever. Even after we die, death is not death, but it's the separation of the body and the soul. So the neshama is what animates us, and the neshama is what makes us human. This is an idea stressed in the Kabbalistic sources, as you see here as well. And if we were to ask, can a computer have a neshama? So what do you think? Presumably not. That one's pretty simple. So if we're going to define Tselem Elokim as having a neshama, so then probably Lambda certainly does not have that. But when we turn to some of the other definitions of Tselem Elokim, we will find that it gets much more complex. So the next source we're going to consider is in a number of thinkers you have over here, the Sforno, the Meshech Chachma, Maharal, and they basically all say that free will is what defines us as human. Tzelem Elohim is our freedom, freedom of choice. So let's ask the question here as well. Can a chat box, can a smart, artificially intelligent machine have free will, free choice? What do you think about that? I know there's some technology people here.
Yes.
It can. How so?
It can be trained to look at the training set of data and then act on that.
Awesome. Awesome. So, you know, with traditional computing, this wasn't a starter, right? Of course, like, you know, if I would have given this year 10 years ago, I mean, maybe people were thinking about it, but I wasn't, right? No such thing. We couldn't imagine even asking the question, can a machine have free will? There were people ahead of their time who realized that it was going to be a question, but I certainly was not thinking about that. But the truth is that it's actually a real question now. Exactly as you're pointing. So that's a good question. That's good, good. So we're going to answer that, or at least try to briefly answer that right now. That's an excellent point. So, you know, one reason why I think it's sort of an interesting question is like this. You know, we make ethical decisions all the time, or decisions relating to whether ethics, right? That's really where our free will is manifest, not so much in, you know, whether we're going to have Cheerios or Raisin Bran for breakfast, but in the ethical dilemmas and decisions that we face. So how is it that a human figures out what is ethical or whether something is ethical or not? So maybe we have some innate sense, but to a large degree, it's from things that we learn, what we're taught, and what we observe and then deduce, extrapolate, right? And those are things that computers can and already do. They could go ahead and look at huge data sets and extrapolate and come up with rules and then answer ethical questions. There's a program, you could look it up when you're done this year. It's free, it's called Delphi. And Delphi, you could ask it your ethical questions. There's like a big, you know, you sign off at the beginning, like don't follow this halach l'maisa. But you could go ahead and ask them your ethical questions and it'll give you answers. And the answers are pretty good. If you start, I should have included on these makoros some questions that I asked it, because you could, you know, at certain points you could start tripping it up a little bit, but it's really good. You have to work hard to get it to say an answer that's wrong, at least that's clearly wrong. How did it do that? Okay, very good, excellent. Good. So we're going to get there. We're going to get there. Excellent. And that's going to be, I think, when we start discussing creativity and the like. Good. But in theory, the answer is you would give different answers. In other words, the more it's learning, the better its answers will become, and they will be different. So how does it work? It works almost like a brain works, except it's not a brain. It goes ahead and it, you know, just like in machine learning, you know, you could show a computer thousands of pictures of a cat, and it then will be able to independently identify what a cat is. So here, the way this one worked is it said that people would answer ethical questions, give answers. It read 1.7 million responses to the questions that it read, and that from there it sort of extrapolated and figured out how to answer these new questions. So even though you're asking it questions that have never been asked, based off of what it's read and learned and figured out, it's giving you answers. So the way it learns how to answer questions is not that different than the way we learn to figure out whether something is ethical or not. So if we were to define free will as the ability to make an ethical choice, so perhaps we could say that it has free will in a sense. I'd like to take a look, though, at the Rambam and look at his definition of free will. And I think that will be very telling. So the bottom of page 2, the Rambam over here writes that we as humans have free will. And what does it mean? So the Rambam gives us a very brief definition of what free will means. And we'll read where it's bolded. Kolomar, he's explaining a pasuk. There's a pasuk from Bereishis. I'll just read the beginning. Rishos l'chal adam nisuna imratza l'hatos atzma l'derech tova l'yos tzadik ha-rishos b'yado v'imratza l'hatos atzma l'derech ra'av l'yos rasha rishos b'yado. So we have a choice to be a tzadik or rasha, do what's right and what's wrong. Hu shekasuv b'torah. This is what the pasuk says. Hein ha-adam hayake achad mimenu l'das tovara. So what does that pasuk mean? Klomar. Rambam is now going to explain this pasuk. Hein min zeh shel adam haya yachid ba'olam. Echad bimenu means he is unique. Man is unique. Ve'en min sheni domet lo bezeh ha'inyan. There is no other creature that is comparable to the human in this respect. Meaning to say, even angels, which are intelligent, but they don't have freedom, or animals, which are below us, there's no other creation with free will. And what does that mean? So, what does the pasuk say? So kechad mimenu means like one of us, unique, right? Yodea tovara. So what does that mean? Says the Rambam, sheyehu, top of page 3, sheyehu me'atzmo b'da'ato v'machshavto, that he, on his own, with his intelligence, yodea hatov v'hara, number one, he knows, able to figure out what's right and wrong. If we can't figure out what's right and what's wrong, so then we don't have meaningful free will. We can't be held responsible. I might have the ability to choose whether to do something or not. But if I can't know that it's right or wrong, I can't be held responsible for that choice. So number one, the first part of free will, meaningful free will, is the ability to determine what's right and what's wrong. That's the first part. But then we have another part. Vose kol ma shu chafetz, to do whatever he wishes. Vein mi shiakev biyado milasos hatovara. Oh, there's nothing holding him back from making that choice. The Kevan Chakanan is as such, so now there's a fear that's the end of the Pasuk Pen Yishlach Yado. Right? That's why we had to be expelled from the Garden of Eden. So, turning back to the machines for a moment. So I think the first part of the definition, they certainly might have. I mean, if you know, it's not quite there yet, but it's on its way to being able to be Yodea Tovara in the sense of knowing what's right and wrong. But I think it's the second part. It's choosing. The idea that we see two options. We see good, we see bad, and we struggle. And we're anguished. And we could go both ways. And sometimes we do go both ways. And we come to that conclusion, whatever it is, right or wrong. That's something that I think computers don't have. So there's an element of free will, perhaps, that they have. You disagree. Unsure. What?
You could program rules that you can say, even to an intelligent, like uh-huh. AI, a machine like a bot, you could say, don't talk about things that sound like this, or...
No, you could.
Or not like these kinds of things. And it could be programmed not to respond, or programmed to...
No, but what about the struggle? That's what I'm saying. Could it have that struggle, that... Like we have, part of our free wills, we see the good, the evil, we see what's right and what's wrong, and we're torn. What do we choose?
It does, it just happens much faster.
But could it choose the wrong thing? Is it tempted? Does it... So, in other words, that's what you're saying. It's programmed to do, it'll do what it's programmed to do. If it's programmed to maximize efficiency, it'll maximize efficiency. If it's programmed, it could be programmed to be evil also. That's true. You could program it, but the question is, part of free will, I think, is the struggle. It's being torn. It's being able to go both ways. It's feeling this dilemma, and then choosing. Yeah.
When you open this year, you talk about various Nafaminas joining the minions, mm-hmm. being able to kill, you know, whatever it was. And I'm just curious: is there like an option to like, fine, maybe it's human that doesn't have Telmolokim or doesn't have free will?
Okay, good. So that's the second half. Part two, we're going to go through those nafkaminas, and it's a great question. In other words, the poskim take all sorts of sides on that question vis-a-vis a golem, and we'll try to think about how that might apply to a robot. Yeah?
So you say it doesn't have free will. Are you saying that it doesn't or it can't?
That's a good question. It would be very foolish to make predictions about the future at this point. But I would say it doesn't, and I can't see how it could. But
you can say that about what we have now 20 years ago.
That's exactly my point. I agree. I that's why I said it would be foolish to make predictions, because absolutely, I would not have imagined 20 years ago what we're talking about today. So absolutely. But so I guess I'll have to come back in 20 years. We'll revisit the question.
I don't have to say anything, it just repeats, but perhaps the formulated as the computer doesn't have ambiguity, in the sense that everything in a computer is it comes down to a zero or one. It's one decision or another. We don't have two binary options, right? We have an infinite number of options, and along the way, right, it's because we're somewhere between. At the end of the day, even if a computer is programmed to be random, to choose one day and one the other, in the end of the day, it has to make a decision. We don't have to make one decision or another. It has to come up with one. The gate has to flip one way or the other.
That's a binary computer. Don't they have quantum computers that have more?
But it's a combination of many different binary options. In other words, it's not.
May I small from itself, meaning it's not us creating the rules that it lives by, but if it were to create its own rules, then would that be any different?
So, you mean shehu me'atzmo b'dato v'machshavto, but that's part of yodea tovara. In other words, I think that it has. I think you could say about it, it's hu me'atzmo b'dato v'machshavto yodea tovara. It's really sort of the second part that I think is where the distinction lies. So let's look at another definition. We have seven, so we have to keep moving. So the next point is in the Rambam. The Rambam clearly says Selam Elokim, relates to the intellect, but I think what's particularly interesting is the aspect of the intellect that the Rambam stresses. So the Rambam emphasizes that it's humans' ability to conceptualize that makes us human, to relate to that which is not physical, concepts, ideas. That's what Selam Elokim means. And the Rambam writes that, you know, we could think about, well, just, you know, concepts like, I don't know, love or truth or goodness or obligation, not just to relate to them, but come up with those ideas, concepts like that, non-physical things, and deal with them. And Rambam says, and most significantly, to be able to relate to the absolutely non-physical thing that is God. To be able to relate to God, to relate to something totally non-physical, non-material. That's what Selam Elokim means. Maybe somewhat along similar lines, Rav Soloveitchik emphasizes creativity. The truth is, in all of these things, you have to go ahead and see, where do you even see, why is it, we don't have time to really focus on this, but it's worth thinking about for a moment, why is it that this is defined as Selam Elokim? I didn't really say. We just said, okay, maybe it's the neshama. Okay, neshama, we could say it's Selam Elokim because in some way it resembles God. Not that God, we truly resemble God. But when we say Selam Elokim, we're saying that there's some aspect in which we're similar. Okay, neshama, fine, there's a non-material part of us, right? Well, why Bechira? Where do you see Bechira Selam Elokim in the first part of Bereishis? Well, the answer is the decision to create man, right? To create the world. That ratzon, that is Bechira. So, what about creativity? Creativity is the most obvious one. In other words, Selam Elokim. Well, what's Elokim in Perek Aleph of Bereishis? It's Bereishis Bar Elokim. It's God as creator. So, Selam Elokim means us, our capacity to be creative, to be creators. And the Rav emphasizes that this isn't just a something that we can do. It's something that we must do. Part of the halachta bedrachav, part of the mitzvah of being like God is being creative like God. It's not just being kind like God, that's certainly part of it, mahu racham, afatate racham, but just like he's a borei, we have to be a borei.
Isn't it for animals that are creative?
So, okay, so let's, in what sense?
I wouldn't say like a beaver making a dam, that's just probably nature. Mm-hmm. Way that they can somehow figure out ways of getting things that they want.
Right. Okay. So good. So what is it? What do we mean by creative that is Selam Elokim? And again, you know, I think with AI, this is even more of a issue, right? There's a great another program that you could try after you're done this year tonight. It's called DALI. And DALI is generates digital images based off of prompts. Now, these are original pictures. Now, unfortunately, you guys have it in black and white. I printed one in color, and I can send it to you. It's quite incredible. But this picture over here, and it's an amazing picture. Again, if you look at it big in color, so this was the following prompt, okay? You give it a prompt, and it makes a picture, an original picture for you. So the prompt was here, a painting of the 2 million Jewish people at Mount Sinai hearing the word of God in the style of Thomas Moran. And you look at this picture, and this is an original picture. It's incredible. Next to it, below over here, you have another picture. This was it's called Edmond de Bellamy, and this was sold. This is, again, an original work of art made by a computer. It was sold for over $400,000 at Christie's. I don't know if you could really see it on the bottom of yours, but if you look on the bottom, there's a equation, which is the equation that was used to make this, right? So these are original things. Could a computer conceptualize? Could a computer be creative? So, on the one hand, I mean, clearly yes. These are creative works. These are original works of art.
Just creating something doesn't mean you're being creative. Oh. Random, like it's just a formula and the answer came out.
Right.
There's no intent behind it.
Good. So I think that's exactly where we need to go, which is that when we talk about knowledge in many of this farm, they talk about different types of knowledge. We have knowledge, information, that is. There's extrapolation, yodea davar mitoch davar. So those types of things, certainly. Computers are much better at that than us. I mean, they could certainly hold much more information, and their ability to extrapolate and come up with new things, in other words, you know, brand new things from the old. But then there's a third type. There is creativity. Let's talk about it. I don't know, artificial unintelligence. So it's just getting upset. It's upset at me that, you know, I'm like digging on technology. It's trying to. That's it. So there is creativity, a chiddush, right? A chiddush is something different than just going ahead and extrapolating from the information that's been fed, even to a new conclusion. And there is an aspect of creativity. I think, you know, you could argue that the greatest act of human creativity is to come up with artificial intelligence. Would artificial intelligence come up with artificial intelligence? The idea, is there an aspect of creativity that isn't really possible for machines? Something to think about. Some other definitions that we need to consider. The Nitziv and Rav Shimon Schwab both emphasize the aspect of Tzelem Elokim, that humans have the ability to handle complexity and contradictions, which is along the lines of what you were saying before. The Nitziv points out that could be seen in the very root of our name, Adam. Adam could be both from Adama, from the ground, or Adamel Elokim, humanly and godly, spiritual and physical. The Rav Schwab, I think, is a great example of this. Rav Schwab writes, says, you see a very fascinating thing. The angels, after the splitting of the sea, said Shira. And God says, what are you doing saying Shira? My creations are drowning in the sea, and you're saying Shira? Inappropriate. Of course, the Jews say Shira, and that was considered a wonderful thing. So what's the difference? So the answer, Rav Schwab says, is because Ein malach echad oseh shnei shluchim. An angel can't handle two things at once, right? You needed three angels to visit Avram and two to visit Lot. They can't have more than one mission. So if you're singing, it means you're rejoicing, you're happy. Well, Is happiness the right emotion to have exclusively at a time when people are dying? No. Inappropriate. Don't say Shira. What about us? We can, as humans, both rejoice in our salvation, in our triumph, as well as... So that's a different answer to the question. It's a good answer. That's Chassam Sofer's answer. Chassam Sofer's answer is, if you were saved, that it's okay to say Shira. But Rosh Chodesh is giving a different answer, I think, which is very profound, which is, no, we can say Shira and at the same time also, in other words, rejoice, but also have the appropriate COVID Rosh for the tragic loss of life. We can hold on to two emotions at once. We can hold on to the dialectical. You know, it's interesting, like the example to Seder, right? We do both. We sing Shira, we take off the drops of wine for the Egyptians. We go ahead and matzah is the symbol of freedom and it's the symbol of enslavement. Just think about how complex the emotions you're supposed to have on Rosh Hashanah are and how in the world they fit with each other. We can be complex. It's not just black and white. We are able to hold on to both of those emotions, contradictory emotions, without even having a resolution or even needing to have a resolution. It's okay. We could live with that gray, with the lack of resolution, and move forward. Think if we think about computers. So obviously, you know, traditional computers, you know, they see a contradiction and then they get stuck and that's it. They, you know, reboot. But certainly with AI, so you have adversarial networks, you have models where you sort of have these complexity. But I still don't feel that it's anything like that human ability to handle the complexity, handle the contradiction, handle the uncertainty, and go on. One last definition. This is, oh, actually two more. We have the Mechtav Meliyahu, Rav Dessler. Rav Dessler talks about the human ability to be altruistic. Altruism, this is back... The Rosh Chodesh, if you want to read it, is on top of page 5. Where did altruism go?
Top of 4.
Top of 4, okay. Yeah, I went out of order. I'm sorry. So, altruism, right? The ability to give, even without any expectation of receiving. Now, a computer, obviously, I mean, it never expects to receive, you know, so it's the perfect altruism. But of course, it's very different because it has no sense of self. Altruism is so difficult because we have that sense of self. We all want to take care of ourselves. We love ourselves. We're looking out for ourselves. And yet, we have that ability to give. That, too, is seen in that opening chapter of Bereishis. God's creation of the world is the ultimate act of altruism in the sense that he needed nothing. He was perfect. And he gave. That's what we're supposed to learn. Finally, emotions. Can a computer have emotions? So certainly, computers can sound like they have emotions. We saw that right away. And the question is, can they really have emotions and form emotional attachments and the like? Might be a question that we can't really answer because we don't actually know what they're... I mean, we don't even know what other people are thinking. Kal vachomer, what the computer is thinking, even if we've programmed it. And there is that aspect, you know. I've spoken to AI engineers who sort of said, we actually see what's happening, and we've programmed it, and we're not exactly sure how it's happening, how it's doing what it's doing. It's actually pretty scary.
I'm
sorry?
You can only tell what's happening from the outputs. You can't actually tell what's happening.
Right.
How the outputs are created.
Exactly. So you could argue that we won't actually be able to know this answer. But I think, at least, maybe I'm just, protecting myself. But it seems to me that real emotions are something that it certainly does not have. Going, you know, and all this, perhaps, these are 7 definitions, but they're overlapping definitions. They come from the same thing. It's... Going back to the first definition, it comes from the merger of the physical and the spiritual, the body and the soul. That's where all of this emerges from. That's where the free will emerges from. That's where the emotions emerge from. The we say, the Ramban points this out. It's towards the bottom of page 4, and this is actually what we say in the bracha. Rofecho basar mafli lasos. What's mafli lasos? This uniting of the physical and the spiritual from which all of this emerges. So if we were to sort of sum things up, you know, where does this leave us? On the one hand, I guess, you know, we should feel pretty good. I mean, so far at least, you know, most of these definitions, if not all these definitions, have not been met. But at the same time, I think that really the opposite is true. We shouldn't rest on our laurels. How many of us have succeeded in actualizing these aspects of our humanity? Okay, we have a neshama, but have we allowed that spiritual side of us to blossom, to develop? It's true, we may have free will, but how many times have we exercised that free will in a true sense? Or are the decisions that we make in life just governed habitually by nature and our nurture and whatever comes into them? How often have we truly exercised that freedom? How many of us connect to the incorporeal and have a relationship with God? Or are we in our lives sort of so focused on the corporeal, on the tangible? How many of us imitate God by being creative? And how many times do we just rehash the same stuff again and again? Are we expressing creativity? Do we live a life in which we embrace complexity, or are we always seeking black and white answers, either yes or no? Do we express our emotions and live our emotions, or do we sort of blot them out? Do we truly give to others? Do we really have altruism, or are the times that we give to others just gifts to ourselves, or trying to quiet our conscience, or whatever it is? So we're certainly humans. But if we don't express our humanity, then we haven't really lived up to that charge of being human. I guess we'll have to stop here. We did 1 out of 3, and I don't know if we'll have to come back to Chicago. But it's really a fascinating topic. I think, you know, maybe look at some of the Marmokomos on the second and third part. But I think that sometimes over here, examples, it's precisely when we're challenged that we have to come up with a solution. So our being unique, our being distinct, that's something we've always taken for granted. Of course humans are unique. Of course there's nothing like us. Well, now, when we see these machines acting humans, I think that can inspire us to say, well, what does it really mean to be human? And hopefully encourage us to become a true, true human being. Live up to that Tzelem Elokim. Yashar Koach.
Thank you, Chairman Biederblank. Thank you, everyone, for coming. We'll have a